This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Thank you so much for joining us for season three. We are super excited to be bringing you more than 20 brand new episodes this year with a whole range of talented folk.
And if you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You can go all the way back to season one to catch up with everyone we've spoken to so far and to hear how our own second book journeys are coming along.
If you are a long-time listener, forgive us, you've heard this before. Like just about every other podcast, we've got a Patreon page where you can pledge a few dollars a month to help us bring you this excellent ear content every fortnight.
Your money goes to paying Phoebe, our amazing producer, and covering the costs of recording studios and the back-end infrastructure. It is an enormous help to us. Thank you to our amazing Patreons so far. Patrons or Patreons, do you think?
Either. Both of them work.
Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.
Catherine. Hi.
Kate. It's very strange not to see you face to face.
Oh, no. Let's talk through where we are and what's happening right now on this very Thursday, the 19th of March, because things have gone a bit awry in the world.
They totally have. I actually read something yesterday, I think, that Jared Leto has been in, I don't know, the desert for 12 days on a yoga retreat and has just emerged to a very, very different world.
Awesome. Like the German Big Brother contestants. It's like it's a great plot for a book, really, isn't it?
It does have the feel of the start of a horror movie, doesn't it?
Oh, my goodness, it's crazy. So we're talking to each other on from our own little separate houses on this day, not in our studio because our studio has quite calmly and rationally been closed down as part of Melbourne City closing down libraries because we're in the midst of the COVID-19. What do we call it?
I feel like we're not even in the midst. We're in the beginning.
We're in the beginning. But for future people who are listening to our podcast, I like that idea of my kids have started writing a diary. I saw it on Twitter somewhere about, you know, this is the moment where you should be journaling what's happening. Because this is what we're going to look back at, right, and say.
That is my number one recommendation that I would make. I think everyone should be journaling, kids, adults. I think it's. Okay.
Number one piece of advice from the first timers. So we are going to, we're making some changes here, like this format, not face to face. I can't tell what you're thinking now when we're talking.
I know, it's weird. We don't even have video on because internet is really bad and I'm waiting to be interrupted by my children.
I have got rid of mine today, so that's okay. We can deal with just yours. So we're at the beginning of this. We're hoping to release this episode to you a little quicker. So we're going to try and get some more ear content to you a little more quickly than we had planned because we know maybe you're going crazy at home. I don't know. Are you going crazy yet, Catherine?
We got sent home from work on Tuesdays to do work from home. And then so Tuesday came home. Wednesday, Thursday are my day with kids anyway, although normally Thursdays Oscar has kinder and Tilly would be at school. Yeah. So I'm not going crazy yet, but it's lunchtime on day two. So
day 50.
Yeah. We're still fresh at the moment. We've still got activity books. We've got, you know, things to do. It's all feeling a little bit novel, I suppose.
Have you got toilet paper? I mean, this is what we should ask, really.
We do. You sort of feel a bit, you don't want to disclose how much toilet paper you have.
Okay, people don't know where
have
you live.
Over, yeah, exactly. But we do have toilet paper. We don't have heaps and heaps, but we have sufficient numbers. My mum actually said that she was like, well, you can just use newspaper. She said that's what we did growing up, which I couldn't believe. I didn't think toilet paper was that recent a phenomenon.
No, I don't know that it is, but I do love the parental attitude of people our age who've got, you know, back in our day, we just coped with pandemics. Anyway, let's move on to writing books, our little industry that's gone into a bit of meltdown. Even though it's crazy times and everyone's feeling uncertain and a bit worried, there is some lovely things happening. What kindnesses have you seen? Have you seen anything that's made you smile?
Actually, it's unrelated to books, but that's the fine. One thing that did make me smile was that Venice saying that as a consequence of the Italian lockdown, all the canals are filled with beautiful clean water and you can see the fish and the swans have come back. Yeah, that is very heartwarming. I said that to Oscar, my son who's 4, and so he's like, I can't wait until we come out of a lockdown and we open the doors and see fish and swans. I'm like, oh, Oscar,
that's the best. You might have lots of people shedding a tear or two now, Oscar. But yeah, listening and paying attention to those things, right? That's one of the things we need to do. I've seen some gorgeous posts from people like Elizabeth Gilbert, Claire Bowditch and Jamila Rivesey have been amazing on Instagram as well on the kind of keeping calm, keep it real. But Elizabeth Gilbert had some nice exercises on being present, noticing things with the senses, you know, 4 things I can see, 3 things I can hear. That kind of stuff of not just being attached to your phone, which I find I have been on the
relentless. I know. I've actually undone Twitter from my phone. Not that I was on it a lot, but then I started getting on it with Corona. And
yeah, it's tricky. It's really tricky. So I think you have to make a balance. And I think that there is a feeling too, especially for book industry peeps, that there's a lot happening on Twitter that they can be doing to support. So I need to be on, but I don't want to be on and I need to walk away, that kind of feeling as well. So let us recommend to you to also step away from the device and the media cycle at certain times, because people will let you know when you need to do things, I think is a helpful advice.
I really do feel for the authors whose books were about to come out.
Mate.
Don't you?
Heartbreaking. I've got some new deliveries. I went out and bought from my local bookshop. I've got Sophie Hardcastle's new Below Deck, and I've got Tweeon's poetry collection Turbulence, and I've got a bunch of other ones coming from readings that are being delivered. So that is something people can do. Heaps and heaps of local bookstores are offering free delivery or postage to you. So Books and Publishing have put together a fantastic list. We'll put a link to it. You can find out if your local bookshop is delivering to you or if you're well enough to go and get some books if you're not self-isolating and bring them home. And there's also some great lists of all the debut books that were coming out.
There's a good Twitter feed through our Twitter handle that has people whose books were just about to come out. And that is the list that I've made and plan to work my way through.
Yeah.
The conundrum for me is, I mean, I took the kids yesterday to Fairfield Bookshop and we got some books there. I never read, I very rarely read paperback books. I read everything on Kindle. I'm having to make a concerted effort, only because I actually think Kindle is a responsible choice in the sense that ebooks are no sort of environmental impact. That is what I hope is a consequence maybe of Corona, is that maybe the independent booksellers industry or something has a more locally based ebook offering.
Yeah, that sounds good. I am astonished. I shouldn't be astonished, but I'm heartened by the speed of innovation, if that
used to buy a little bit of ebooks from Angus and Robertson online, ebooks that you could convert. They weren't readily downloadable to Kindle, but you could put them through a conversion program that wasn't probably strictly above board that would then allow you to get them on Kindle.
Okay.
But something sort of more accessible than that would be great.
These things will be coming. When we walk out our door, we'll see fish and we'll see local delivery. There's some other things, and this is by no means an exhaustive list, but hopefully people can just keep sharing via Twitter and Instagram, or drop us a line and we'll try and spread the love. Anna Whatley's been doing this fantastic OzChat series on YouTube, which she kind of has got up and running in the last 4 days. And she's talking to writers about how they're feeling right at the moment and their books, etc. So if you just, it's at hashtag OzChats, or look at Anna Whatley on Twitter or YouTube, you'll find it. We'll put links to all of this. There's also something coming from the Love Oz YA community. We don't know what that is yet, but keep following Love Oz YA as well, because that looks like it will be terrific and a way for people to launch and talk and continue to socialize at a time we can't socialize. if that makes sense.
And we're also hoping to have a bit of an offering for people as well. So watch this space for that.
Watch this space. We have, sadly, but we know you'll understand, had to postpone our Brisbane trip to Avid, but we are thrilled to let you know that we'll be bringing you still all those interviews with the fantastic writers we were going to catch up there in a live event. We'll be bringing you those interviews, and we will be encouraging you to purchase those authors' books via Avid Bookstore if you can, or by another local independent bookstore as well. I wanted to also say that people should check out City of Literature. Have you had a look at that, where you can pitch to the City of Lit?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, so City of Lit, the Melbourne City of Literature, if you check them out on Twitter, they're accepting some pitches from writers. They've also got a Facebook group. I know Writers Victoria are moving a whole bunch of their programs online. So do be engaging with your normal writing community, because a bunch of the stuff that you might feel like you're going to miss out on is they're working really rapidly to change that and have that happen in other ways. Still feels
exciting.
It's exciting.
It feels big.
Are you writing yet? How have you been through this time?
Well, I have been doing a picture book short course through the Australian Writers' Centre, which is one thing I would plug, is online courses. Victorian Writers' Centre has a bunch of online courses that they're offering, and the online course is perfect for a world in which, you know, self-isolation is a pretty big part of. So I'm doing that course. It's good. I'm listening to the audio. I would say that I'm glad that you have a year's access to the course, because I'm not really feeling the most creative person in the world. And then mostly just rehashing old picture book concepts that I sort of had on my old computer.
Yeah.
So it feels like a little bit of a lost opportunity, but it still makes me feel connected. And that it's good. Excellent. The only real thing I'm writing is journaling. And by journaling, I would say the Helen Garner approach to journaling. If that's a great book, if people haven't read it, Helen Garner's diary. I think with diaries, the thing that I have kept them on and off for years, and what has been the biggest hurdle, is I've felt like I've had to do so much setup for a day's entry, but she just literally does the moment of what happens. And I think that's a really sustainable way to do it.
That's such a sustainable way. Even I've taken to just putting dot points in my tiny little diary too.
Perfect.
Just I've seen all that happens. I think it's, and also you will thank yourself at the end of the year and in times to come that you have journaled how you're feeling right now. Cause I think that's important too.
One small thing that I do, I'm less gratitude-y, I suppose, but whenever I'm in a boring meeting or coming home from work in the car, my sort of daily practice is to think across the boring meeting or the day or the whatever, and think, if I had to find a vein of humour in that meeting in that day, where would it be? What moment would you expand upon? Yeah, I think it's a good practice. Like, it's less gratitude-y, but it sort of encourages you to look at something a little bit differently.
Let's go right down into that. You're just thinking about that, or you're noting that in your diary as well at the end of the day?
Increasingly, I'm noting it, but it was, I think it's really good. You start to look for different things, and then just sort of as a mental exercise more than anything is to play around with how you would manipulate that.
Excellent. That's really good.
And what about you?
Well, I am trying to keep in mind, I saw someone share today what the director of Writers SA, Jessica Ellis, said, which was keep writing. In uncertain times, we must go on. Storytelling will help us through this worldwide event, and it is how we will recover too. Your writing is more important than ever. And I think for writers who are in the middle of projects or who are feeling completely bound up by anxiety, you know, just giving yourself small moments every day where you are just allowing yourself back to the writing, back to you and the page, whether you're doing 5-minute, you know, short timed exercises or giving yourself Pomodoro or however you're doing it, let yourself go back to the page. And I think no pressure on what you're producing either. I love those threads of people who are getting things from their universities, like, oh, now that you're working at home, you'll be able to finish the PhD, or, you know, be like Shakespeare coming up with King Lear. Like, bullshit, bugger off.
Shakespeare obviously did not have children, can I say?
Someone else was looking after them for sure. ridiculous. I also wanted to, and I think we've plugged this before, but Sarah Centilli's, her conversation with Charlotte Wood, How Can You Write While the Earth is Burning, I think is particularly relevant at this time. So we'll share a link to that as well. Yeah, I'm actually trying to get into it by reading. So I've got a bunch of books. My library hasn't closed yet. And when I went in to kind of return books that I'd read and pick up some on hold, and they've increased the loan limit to 60 items per person.
Wow.
So
House is shut down with like an hour's notice. It was
Wow. Okay. So we're still, you know, there's lots of space between us out here in the sticks. So we're still a little bit. But I've also really got my shelf happening for the new project. So a bunch of fiction and nonfiction and research stuff. So I feel like if I can, you know, really fall into the reading again. I just read Actress by Anne Enright. Goodness, I wish that book went on forever. But, you know, you fall, if the book is really well done, you fall all the way into it. And then I think that's
true. It's very inspiring, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'm going to focus on reading and then, trying to punch some words out after that. Having said that, I acknowledge, you know, if I get the family WhatsApp going with someone saying, what are we going to do about this? Or have we thought about this? Or how's grandma? Then obviously your brain is completely gone. So I think people should also be gentle with themselves, you know, no pressure to produce
right now.
So stay safe over there.
The only other one thing I was going to add was I think it's really important to support other writers and the industry at large. Please also donate blood.
It's
a really, really simple thing. I must admit, I'm very unsympathetic to people who say they can't donate blood because they don't like needles. I've never met a person in my life who likes needles. You just sort of grit your teeth and bear it. But now's the time. It's cost you nothing. It's a little bit of effort and it's a big return. So that would be my community service announcement.
That's such a good point. Excellent community service announcement. Stay safe out there, people. Look after yourselves. We'll be back, won't we, Catherine?
We will. We'll be in your ears soon. So might my children. They're going to come in.
Robert Lucan's debut novel, The Everlasting Sunday, was published in Australia by UQP and Penguin Random House in 2018 and in Italy in 2019. His work has appeared in Crikey, Overland, The Big Issue, Rolling Stone, Broadsheet, Time Off, Impress, and other odd places. Robert Lukens, welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I'm very, very excited to talk to you about writing process because I know, and I imagine many of our listeners know, you have written a lot of manuscripts. Do you remember the first one you ever wrote?
Yeah, it's funny.
You want to comment on the fact that you've written a lot of manuscripts?
Well, I do in a way because it keeps circling back around to me. And I do get it. It's funny because when I first started, my first novel came out, I started doing interviews and things, and it never occurred to me that was part of my backstory. In a way, this novel, I thought that we'd just be talking about this one. I think somewhere along the line, it just came up in an interview that I've basically written a novel a year since I was 13. So, and of course,
Adrian Moore, like it is so Adrian Moore.
Yeah, yeah, and quite specifically, it is Adrian Moore actually, because that was a. He's a great influence on both my writing and my life. But that's a much longer.
It's so interesting you say that because I did actually hear an interview where you talked about Adrian Mole. And I feel like Adrian Mole had a really massive influence on me. But yeah. I think in a completely different way.
I think too, it was at that really magical age when you're 7, 8, 9, and if you get the bug of reading, you devour these things and they have such a high place in your life. But also, I think just maybe even intellectually or emotionally, you're in a bit of a grey zone in terms, like you live in these books.
Yeah.
These books exist. And I know to me, I never thought about authors. I never thought Sue Townsend, a middle-aged woman in England, was writing this. I was reading Adrian Mole's diary and he was real. You know, when you're at that age, you can really suspend disbelief very easily and these worlds become real. And that's why these books you read as a kid, they stay with you forever and you talk about them. And even later when you go and revisit them, you've got an adult mind and you've got a mortgage and you've got all this kind of stuff and you can't get back to that place again, that really deep place. And that's why so often I think you go and watch Neverending Story or something and it's terrible. It's a terrible film. But when you were eight and you were so emotionally invested in it, you were lost in that world, in the same way with books, I think. And so I tend not to try and read those childhood books. But Adrian Mole stands up. It's genuinely
beautifully crafted
piece
of
work.
Some of the latter, I think there's the cappuccino years and pieces towards the end. Maybe.
I think basically everything from him being an adult onwards. Yeah. I think Sue Townsend, what works so well in those early books and something you come to realise as you get older is those just real subtleties of the world around Adrian Mole and the broader political landscape and that kind of portrait of England in the 1980s.
And his naivety to
And that's our window, is his naive viewing of these kind of things, and his mother having an affair, which you know, but he doesn't, because you can see through the things he doesn't understand. And it's all done so subtly in those early books, and I feel like it's forced a little in the later ones. Because in the later ones, he's actually writing letters to Tony Blair and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. Like, it becomes a bit overt, but there's something pretty magical in those early ones.
So you took some of your literary cues from Adrian Mole, started writing at 13. Do you remember what the first manuscript was about?
Back to that. I do, actually. I thought of it for the first time maybe a week ago. It just popped into my head, and I haven't thought of this thing 25 years. So I think I would have been, and I should say I don't remember a time when I wasn't writing in some form. From my earliest memories, I had my brother's hand-me-down typewriter. He's much older than me, and he went off to university and bought a new typewriter and gave me his old clunky one. So I was surgically attached to this thing. And I think there was even something about the mechanical nature of that typewriter. It was so satisfying as a seven-year-old to be making that racket in the back room. So I was just producing what I thought were great works of literature, but they were probably short stories about my rabbit or something. But then, yeah, there definitely was a moment of a very self-consciously writing that first novel. I was writing a novel, and I think I would have been about 14. And in my mind at the time, I was such a pretentious little thing. It was very much me finally pulling together all the threads of thoughts and ideas and my views on the world. And it was finally all these loose pieces that I've been putting out in the world, they were all going to come together in this one, my novel.
Magnus.
And it was called The Rock. And I should say this was before the film The Rock came out, so I thought it was a pretty good, it's not a bad title at the time. And The Rock is an asteroid that's hurtling through space. It's the size of a two-story house. And sitting cross-legged on this asteroid is a faceless, nameless, naked human. And that's the novel. So the entire novel takes place on this asteroid, and we're just inside the mind of this grey, faceless human having all their profound thoughts about life and existence and the universe.
This novel says a lot about you as
what an unbearable child I must have been to be around.
Philosophical, that's amazing.
And you know, it's funny because it popped into my mind, and at first I thought, well, what a ludicrous idea for a novel. And the more I think about it, it's not a bad idea for a novel, but it's a novel that a 94-year-old person should write, not a 14-year-old on the Sunshine Coast.
I mean, you've clearly always had a very literary bent, literary in that
capital
continuum. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. And I think in some ways I've kind of spent the last 10, 15 years of my life trying to undo some of that, because I very much formed all my reading literary influences, just kind of influences in my life really, from the Penguin classic version of what literature is. And that very much came from my public library. So the Cotton Tree Council Library, my life centered around that building. So when I was very young, my brother and sister are a lot older, and they both had their first jobs working at that library. And my father worked in a tiny office that was attached to that library. So every day after school, I'd catch the bus from my primary school and have to wait for my brother or sister to finish work and my dad to finish at the office. And so every afternoon I would spend 3 hours at the public library.
Do you know, we did the same thing? I didn't spend 3 hours, but every day after school I had to go to the library and then wait there for an hour and then walk home.
Yeah,
and it was my place.
They're gracious too. And also, like, and not to go too far into it, but like, in it was free. That was a big thing in my family, was this was a place you could go for free. And what a place. So this was my domain. You know, this was the place I could just, and I would walk down and smell the books and see centuries of literature sort of stretching out before me. And I think something about, I just kind of built up a grand picture of literature from this place. And I saw it as my kind of mission to work my way through what a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, I just went to those books I'd heard about on Adrian Mole, or you'd read the introduction to War and Peace and it would mention something else, a book by Zola or something. So I thought, well, this is the job. And so I started just working my way through those very heavy. There was something as well about, I think, to an 8-year-old, like picking up something that's literally just a very thick book. There's something very special about that and transportative, and something I felt like I was touching something that ran back through time, and it was a real escape for me.
So you start writing yourself. You mentioned that you wrote a book a year.
Yeah,
I imagine.
Yeah, it's something about the rhythm of the year or something. That just seemed to be how.
Is that how long it sort of took?
Yeah. And there was something, and it's funny because we mentioned about all these manuscripts I wrote, and in the past I hadn't talked about them. And now every time I do an interview, people ask me about them. And I understand the interest. And in the past, I've always just said, people say, why did you write 25 novels before The Everlasting Sunday? And I used to always just say that I was teaching myself how to write. And that is true. That is completely true. I very much approached every, and they weren't novels, they were novel length pieces of writing.
Yeah, I do wonder if they're, because a lot of people start with short stories. They could be short stories that are actually just really long.
Yeah, I suspect they were. They certainly didn't work as novels.
Yeah.
It was me teaching myself how to. So it was me setting myself tasks, setting myself conundrums to write my way out of. Like, can you write a whole novel is set in an empty room with no characters? Write a novel
that
about
is like
that.
The definition of literary. Like, isn't it? Nothing happens. the paint is.
But it's interesting.
I don't even have the words. But
yeah, and it's funny, so that instinctual thing, because like, I was, every one of these, I look back on them now, they all had containment devices. It was always a novel set on a bus. You have to write the whole novel, they can't get off the bus.
There's so much creativity within confines, though, isn't it? Sometimes that is a really exciting thing.
Yeah, and I realised it was setting that that limit around it actually gave me something to do, because if the limit is just the world or the universe and all time, where do you start? So they were really writing exercises, but I realise now there's probably more to it than that, and especially the fact that this went on for so long, for decades. I think I was always really attracted to, I suppose, creating a piece of art. And for a public school kid from the Sunshine Coast, even saying the word art, all my muscles in my body tense up saying it, but it's true. I was always attracted to this idea of creating a piece of art for its own sake, I suppose. So. And maybe it's tied into this idea that when I was young and I was reading books, I never thought of authors. I never thought of publishing. Yeah. I thought of books. And what I was addicted to, what I was so compelled by, was just the actual act of writing itself.
Mm.
And so there was something about just wanting to keep writing and writing. And it was never, and there was this kind of.
So it sounds like a very private thing too.
It was a completely private thing. And that was the other thing against the, it was mine. It was kind of the one thing in my life that was containable, and it was mine, and also it was against a backdrop of a kind of world that didn't appreciate that and didn't value that and didn't have a place for that, and it really became tied into my identity of who I was. That was who I thought it was, against kind of chaos around me. It was the thing I did. I was a writer in my room, and I became so attached that was what I did, and I enjoyed that I did that against this kind of chaos around me, and also just doing it for its own sake, that was enough in itself. I enjoyed the writing so much. And it's something, it's funny, I'm still so attracted to that idea of, you know, the idea of writing a poem on a piece of paper and making it as beautiful as you can, as perfect as you can, and then folding it up into a paper boat and just pushing it off into the ocean.
Well, it's like Mandela art or something like that, isn't it, where they just... The monks make these amazing things out of sand.
Yeah. And to me, it becomes by definition a kind of meaningless object. A book that you write in your room that no one ever reads is kind of by definition, in practical terms, of a meaningless object. But by taking away any kind of practical concerns, if it's not to be published or to be read or to turn into something else, to turn into a product or something, it exists purely for itself, and there's something so kind of powerful and mischievous and rebellious and inspiring to do that. So I'd write these things and at the end of them think, I love this. This is beautiful. I love this thing. And then just let it go. And there was something it made me feel so free. It made me feel so in charge of my own destiny. You know, it made me feel in charge of myself that I could just create these things.
Did it feel like in charge disciplined or in charged? That just seems so extraordinary.
I think
because it's the freedom of creation.
Yeah. I think too, part of it is it was trying to create a place of peace. I keep using this word chaos, but there was this writing became a constant thing too. So the writing never stopped. Writing was this thing I always did, and it was a constant in a life that at various times didn't have a lot of constancy outside of that. So I think it was all tied too to these ideas of discipline around writing, and I certainly was committed to this idea of writing being a lifelong skill that would take a long time. But I think there was just something about, and particularly in my life at various points when I was younger, the idea that I was in this world and I was the I could create this thing and
let it go.
And there were some negative connotations to it. There was an element of screw the world. You know, I've just created this thing that I think is beautiful, this beautiful piece of art, and now it's just...
And you don't get to see it.
Poof, it's gone. A little bit of that, yeah. And I think so much, especially the last few years of my life, especially since this novel has come out, I've kind of reassessing a lot of that stuff. And The Everlasting Sunday coming out in a huge way was the end of a very long part of my life and a very one particular way of approaching writing. And it was a...
We'll talk about The Everlasting Sunday, because I suppose that very clearly marks a turning point, because you decided...
Yeah.
And was this the first manuscript that you decided to send?
Yeah, it was. It was. And I decided before I wrote it that it was going to be the one that I sent out. And it was... It's interesting. I try and think back. There wasn't a particular moment. There wasn't a light bulb went off, or there wasn't even a decision. It really did just feel like I'd come to the end of a certain long, long road and of complete isolation. And I think as I wrote and wrote and wrote and setting these assignments for myself, I was actually just treading water. I wasn't getting closer to some kind of voice. I was just filling in time, and something just happened, and just like I usually did, I finished whatever it was I finished before and went to a blank page, as I always did, just to start writing the next one. But something had just organically changed in me, and I suddenly just thought I just wanted to drop all this. It was kind of a weight. Every manuscript I wrote was a weight on my back.
Because was it a lot of time that you were spending writing manuscripts?
Yeah, it was every spare second I had. Yeah. You know, because I'd had a normal life, and especially when I was younger, had lots of troubles with money and jobs and all this kind of stuff. So it was always something that was just eked into the moments. It was a complete, utter commitment to, you know, and things suffered. It friendship suffered, relationship suffered. It was this thing in my life that I always returned to. But yeah, when I sat down to write just the next novel, I just suddenly realized I needed to finally drop all this stuff and approach this just with a kind of take a breath and just finally see good or bad, where am I at, both in my writing and in my life, and just to write something. And it wasn't an intellectual conceit. It wasn't a philosophical exercise. Even if it's terrible, even if it's cliched, even if it's just repeating something else, whatever it is, just write that first novel, even though I'd written all this other stuff. I hadn't actually done that thing where I sat down to write a first novel.
There's self on the line.
There's a huge self-protection element to it too. When I'm sitting in my room writing literally millions of words that aren't placed under any kind of scrutiny or sent out, you know, it might have been The Shining. I might have just been writing gibberish on a page. Who knows? So there definitely is an element of that too, especially because so much of my personality was and my life was tied up in that I was a writer.
Mm.
And against a backdrop of various times hardship, it was the thing I clung to, that against anything, no matter what was going on, I'm a secret writer. This is the thing I love doing. And so there was a definite fear that it would kind of burst the bubble of that, that I'd lose contact with that.
It's hard putting...
But it was interesting. When I went to write that first novel for the first time, I found it was such a peaceful, beautiful, enthralling, euphoric experience. It was such a beautiful experience writing that novel, and it came easier than anything I'd ever written, because for the first time I wasn't sort of whipping my own back while I was doing it. I wasn't punishing myself. I wasn't doing any of these kind of negative things that are built up around it. I was just being really generous to myself and to the book, and to... I wasn't necessarily thinking of readers, but I was trying to just fill this book with love and just make it as and expose myself as much as I could, and there were and potentially write elements of my own life and feelings and things and all these kind of things that you normally do with a first book. And just to do that was just such a beautiful experience, and it came so quickly. And when it finished, it's not that I thought it was so amazing or that it was a perfect novel, but it was completely what it was. It was exactly what I started out wanting to write, and it just felt whole. It didn't feel perfect, but it felt whole. Mm. And so when I finished it, I sent it off.
And you sent it to UQP.
Yeah.
Can I just say, though, firstly, it is a really beautiful, like your writing is so incredibly beautiful. And it made me think of a tweet by Ben Hobson that he did it, it was probably a couple of years ago now, but he talked about writing and, or maybe his book was coming out and he was in that sort of frenzied uncertainty. And so he would just pull books off the shelf and open them up and read a random sentence and then compare it to a random sentence in his book just to get a gist of, am I okay? But I feel like if you pulled The Everlasting Sunday off the shelf and read a random sentence, I would feel crushed. Like it is, the writing is so beautifully poetic. Oh,
thank you. That's lovely to hear.
I'm interested. What do you see as, you know, when you write a sentence and you're like, I'm really happy with that sentence. Mm. What does perfect or great, what does a great sentence or great writing look like to you?
Yeah, it is. I heard George Saunders talk about this, and he talks about this idea that's being a sort of needle on your forehead, and that as you're becoming a better writer is just that you basically becoming a better reader, that you just, I guess on a kind of instinctual level, are able better to feel. The needle just goes up to one end. I think I'm especially writing The Everlasting Sunday. It was a completely instinctual process that I if it's working, I'm not in the slightest bit thinking about sentence construction.
But do you aspire for beauty or do you aspire for, I mean, I remember, and I don't know if I feel this way anymore, but I did an application for a creative writing course years ago and they asked a question about writing. And I think I said I thought perfection in writing was like a Far Side cartoon, that it was short and clean and succinct, but funny generally.
And whole and complete. Yeah.
But I read yours, I normally will read so quickly, but your writing, I kept going back to read for the joy of the sentence.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. I feel slightly lost at knowing how to answer the question. It is that feeling of something feeling whole to me. It is that feeling of something feeling. It is funny when I think of, it's in the same way when I just read someone else's work. Something, it's a satisfying feeling. Yeah. It's a whole feeling. It's a complete feeling. And it's probably different depending on, it's not about ornamentation. So a great sentence isn't that it's got a pearl dangling from every letter. It can be, it needs to serve its purpose.
That's all right. We'll keep it's going. It is a hard question. Okay. So you send it out to UQP, you send it to an agent. Yep. What happens next?
Yeah. So I literally just printed two copies of it out, and I had very deliberately knew nothing of the publishing industry. Because I was pushing the idea of publishing as far away as possible. So I literally knew nothing. And I had this weird, even when I decided to send it to UQP and I sent it to Curtis Brown, I couldn't even bring myself to read their submission guidelines. And I found out later UQP did not have open submissions when I sent that book in. And Curtis Brown, I just Googled who's the boss of Curtis Brown.
Yeah.
And it's Fiona Inglis.
This is against all advice. Oh, absolutely. That it's terrible advice. You, isn't it?
And I printed off two copies, and I'm sure I didn't tie them up with string, but I may as well have. I just put them in a brown envelope, and I wrote one to the Fiona Inglis at Curtis Brown, sent it off. No synopsis, No, couple nothing. Letter. And I sent one. I don't know why, but instead of writing the publisher, I wrote the editor at UQP. So it went off.
Oh, great.
And that ended up.
So you knew a bit.
Yeah. That ended up actually having repercussions. So I sent these two things off and then heard absolutely nothing for 18 months. Not a reply, not a receipt, I did no idea if they'd gotten there. And I'd sent these things off and kind of just in the act of sending them off, it felt wonderful anyway. And then 18 months passed of silence. And then within 3 days of each other, I got an offer of publication and an offer of representation.
That is bizarre, the timing.
Yeah, and it is, and it's not at all a helpful story. Well, I tell this story sometimes around people trying to get published, and it's a terrible story because it's the falling ass backwards into luck. And it really was. I know, I'll try and give the short version, but basically Grace Heifetz, who ended up representing, I found out later that at one point that manuscript had literally been on the desk of every single agent at Curtis Brown. Not because they thought it was so great. I think it was just because this brown envelope was just kind of being footballed around the office. And Grace Heifetz had it and just decided on a punt to take some books from the slush pile home. And she lives in the Blue Mountains. And that weekend, the Blue Mountains had a snowstorm. So she was trapped inside her house with the snow pelting down. She started reading my novel, which is about a bunch of people trapped inside a house during a snowstorm. And I think there was something about that environment. So she just read it and there was something about the environment she was in or something. So she had to read this book in a day. And I was just incredibly lucky it struck a chord with her. And Ian C., my fairy godfather at UQP, my editor, he was going on holidays, and editors don't take holidays. So he took the top three manuscripts off the slush pile before he went on his flight. And he had a 7-hour flight, and mine was the first one on the pile. And he read it over that flight. And when he landed, he sent an email to Madonna Duffy, the publisher, saying,
"So the time was not, deliberation time. That 18 months was waiting to be read.
It was rotting in a pile." Yeah.
Which says something about having connections and things like that, doesn't it?
And I do think about that now, and it kind of gives me chills because it relied on pure luck. I didn't know anyone in the publishing industry. I had no contacts. I had no resume. I'd never published a work of fiction in any size or form. So again, not a helpful story, but maybe it's a hopeful story.
So you had, as we've discussed, spent a lot of time writing on your own and all of those sorts of things. The book gets picked up and published.
Yeah.
How did you go about building a community of writers around you? Did you know writers already?
Not one. I'd never met a writer in my life. To my own, and it's so funny, this really, I do see my life in two parts. I see it as pre this book coming out and post, both professionally, in terms of my writing and personally, because it really changed my life. I really actively tried to just meet writers.
Yep.
And a lot of that actually came online. So first thing you do, you meet with a publisher and they look you up and they go, "You don't have a social media presence. Get one." So I thought, and I felt really uncomfortable about it.
It is really tough.
So I just made a deal with myself that if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to be on Twitter, and Twitter's kind of the place that writers hang out, more so than Instagram, etc.
Where you make more friends on Twitter than is possible.
Well, there's more conversations, isn't there? And I just thought, if I'm going to do this, the only way I'll feel okay in the morning to open up Twitter and look is if I'm completely genuine and completely honest and really just trying to meet people. It really was as simple as that. So it definitely wasn't about networking, or that turns out to have been a consequence of just trying to meet other interesting people. I was having a book come out and I'd never met a writer in my life. And so I literally just looked up writers that I liked and followed them on Twitter.
Yeah.
And barge my way into their conversations. And
you are excellent on Twitter, can I say.
Well, thank you.
You are. You're great. Well, but that genuineness comes across.
Yeah, well, it's the only way I could feel comfortable. I mean, we all make mistakes on social media, especially in your early stages.
Tell us about your mistakes.
Well, no, just when especially when your book's coming out.
Oh.
You're excited.
Yeah.
And it's the place to do it. And you probably, you know it, nine times out of 10, you haven't made a mistake. You think you've pushed yourself too much. You think you've put, you think you've meant, if you hear the name of your book one more time, you're going
to
be sick.
But I feel like you feel a debt to someone who mentions your book. Like,
absolutely.
I feel like that's half the time why I'm saying
this. Yeah, there's a real triangulation of if someone reviews your book, your poor old publisher has sunk money into this. The publicist worked their ass off. They've done everything to get that review, even if it's like just on a blog or something, like no one might ever hear this. And that person they've read your book. They maybe even liked your book. They've written something out. And then for you just to sit there I think that's fine. And the other thing I realized too, especially once you get to know a lot of writers online, everyone gets it.
Yeah.
No one holds it against you. If you've got a book out and someone's reviewed it in the Australian or something, no one's going to hold it against you if you go, "So excited, got a review." Like, that's great. And 99 times out of 100 people are genuinely happy for you. And it's just lovely to share those things. So no one, even though sometimes you feel that kind of self-promotion anxiety and weariness. Most of the time people don't hold it against you.
I agree with that. You also have a literary nemesis.
I do, I'm proud to say.
Yeah, you and Sarah Schmidt, who I don't know, but I have followed your interactions.
Count yourself lucky.
Yeah. Fine. So how did that eventuate? Who offended who first?
I think it was in the... It was in the very early stage. I think it was my book hadn't quite come out yet. It was coming out. And by that stage, people, you know, the other thing is other writers just want to know other writers too. So I found, I thought I was sort of, you know, because I really admire people like Jane Rawson and a bunch of other writers online. So when I first sort of started sidling into their conversations, I thought they're not going to, this pipsqueak comes in. They love meeting other writers. They want to talk about books. So it's people are very open to it. And writers don't know as many people. You think everyone else is so connected and has you're trying to like get into this cool group kind of thing. But they often don't know as many people as you think they do. So they're looking for friends too. And I think at some point I was just, everyone's so nice and that's a great thing. And I love nice. And I think there was something that happened that day. And I just thought, there's no rivalries anymore. Like there's no, and there are secret ones. And once you get to know writers, you realize there's lots of them. But I was just being mischievous one day. And I remember just thinking, so I advertised my services on Twitter to be a submissive in a literary nemesis situation online. I was just curious. I just thought, I just wanted something, you know, because I think that day I just read one too many tweets of everyone being nice to each other. Oh, no one hates each other anymore. And I think I can never remember whether it was Jane Rawson or Justine Hyde, who both know Sarah Schmidt. And they thought, they put Schmidt in touch with me. And said,
what they like?
They know Sarah Schmidt. And they know what a piece of work she is. And so they put.
That she would be willing to oblige.
They just kind of went, hey, Schmidt, this kid, I reckon he's
take
yours.
Take him down.
And then they just stood back and watched. And it's been a constant source of delight. The evening spent at home with my needle and thread fashioning a voodoo doll with her face on the front, it brought me so much pleasure. And she's been in bookshops all around the country holding up my book, taking photos, vomiting over my book and defacing my book. It's been delightful.
Oh, we need more.
You do.
Nemesis relationships. Right. So since The Everlasting Sunday,
yep.
I know you've worked you have at least one unpublished manuscript because it was in the Authors for Fieries auction. This was an item that you had auctioned. Mm-hmm. How was that, sending that to someone? Was that a hard process?
No, it was fine. Because I actually have a great affection for that piece of that novel I wrote. So I wrote The Everlasting Sunday, and then after that my head was just in a bit of a spin and I hadn't gone through the process yet of working out what the hell it was I was going to do with my writing, what I wanted to do next. So I really quickly wrote another novel in very much the same way I used to write novels, just sit down, bash it out in an intuitive kind of subconscious way.
That across was, a period of?
6 months,
yep.
12 months. I knew when I wrote that was just going to be just to clean out the pipes.
Yeah.
And then I sat down to write my next novel.
Yeah.
Worked very hard on it. It didn't work.
Yeah. What point did you discover that?
Oh, when it was well and truly complete, edited. I thought this was going to be my next novel.
Yeah.
It's a long story, but in short, what I tried to do was write the exact opposite of my first novel. And in the past when I've written, each novel was always something to rebel against the last one.
Yeah.
Again, as this kind of intellectual exercise. So I went to write my next novel. I thought, right, I'm going to write, my last novel was atmospheric, romantic, this kind of dense atmosphere. So I'll write something the complete opposite of that. I'll suck every last bit of atmosphere and character out of this story. So I wrote this.
Seems an odd approach.
It does in hindsight. So I wrote, I wrote this next novel, realized afterwards it didn't work. And that's the novel that I sent off to someone that I don't know who lives out in the bush somewhere. Haven't heard anything back.
Oh.
But you know, it's...
This is not dissimilar to the previous process, though, really, is it?
Yeah.
If it goes into the abyss.
I really feel like it genuinely feels like it's just been in the last 3 years since my first novel came out. And it sounds like a cliche, but it really is true. I really am just now learning how to write. Because before it was just this very insular, personal, self-taught way of writing. And it was because I think to open myself up to the idea that there's lots of things I can learn from other people, there's lots of technical things I can. I always thought writing was this high wire act you did on instinct. You just slugged down some whiskey and just kind of magically danced your way to the end of a novel. So the last 3 years really has been a huge upheaval in the way I write, and it's about just being so much more open and learning and doing really boring things I thought I would never do, like getting books out of the library about how to write a book.
Oh.
Studying how I always shied away from the idea of analyzing how novels were written. These were just magical things that came into being just by having spent a life reading and writing. You just through osmosis learned how to write a novel. And so it was a really humbling experience, and especially writing that. So I've now written 3.5 novels since The Everlasting Sunday, and it's been a really wonderfully humbling experience. And I think I'm twice the writer now than I was then.
Which is probably a good segue into advice for other writers. We're talking about second books this season. Mm. Are you working on something at the moment?
Yeah, I'm a really long way into something.
Oh, that sounds positive. So what advice would you have? What's helping along
for
the way?
A second novel?
Yep.
I think as I did, when I meet other people who have written one book and they go to write their second, there is this strange compulsion to abandon everything you've learnt before. This idea that that must have been a fluke or something, and that now I need to be a proper writer. Now I need to think about the audience. I need to think about a publisher. I need to think about how things are done and what was the last popular book last year, all this kind of stuff. And it's understandable because now things are different. You're a capital W writer. And I think the process for me was about the idea that if you got a book of fiction published in Australia, you were tapping into something. Like you had something, whether it was just innate ability or you analyzed the system or you had whatever it was, you did something. You were tapping into some kind of power or magic or something. And so you don't want to abandon that. So I think it's just the idea for me that I can learn a lot of new things and I can learn from other people and I can take new approaches, but that doesn't mean to throw away everything that got me to this place. So I know for me it was kind of falling back to that I'm that writer that could get published before and that I can just add to my arsenal of tricks or my skills or how I want to do this. So in some ways it was almost returning to that place you were before you wrote that first novel, that you don't need to entirely reinvent yourself. You can just grow from where you were. So I think it's maybe a little bit about having faith in that person you were before that first book was published.
That is a great note to end on.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's been such a delight. I'm a long-time listener.
Robert Lukens, do you have a favourite novel by a debut author?
I have one I'd really like to plug. It is a novel that came out a couple of years ago, and it got a couple of nominations for awards and things, but it didn't get nearly the attention I think it deserved. It's The Bonobo's Dream by Rose Mulready. Mm-hmm. It won the Viva Novella Prize.
Oh, I know that competition.
It is such an exquisite book. It's a novella-ish short novel. It's very hard to describe. It's written with it's some of the most delicious, gorgeous, beautiful, elegant prose you've ever read by an Australian or international author of all ever. But it's the most bonkers story about this future dystopian society living under a glass dome and people dating bonobos and chemical engineering society.
Amazing.
It's the most incredible story matched, these kind of two worlds clashing together. The only thing I can think of, it's like if Evelyn Waugh decided to write a dystopian future novel, which he actually did, but it's such an amazing thing. And I think part of it is because, a disclaimer, I've since gotten to know Rose Mulready, but I very much firmly had this opinion of her novel before I met her. But I think part of it is her bashfulness to ring her own bell. But so I'm here to do it for her. It's
excellent,
an amazing
recommendation.
Novel.
Good one. Who's it published by?
Seizure.
Robert Lukens, The First Time, Quick Five. For your first time, you can pass on any question. Agent or no agent?
Agent.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Did your book come out? We've realised we have to clarify this question. Did your book come out just in Australia, New Zealand, or in overseas territories as well?
It came out in Italy as well and maybe somewhere else sometime.
Oh, that sounds like an announcement.
Definitely not an announcement.
Okay. not sure what to make of that. Okay. Festival invites or no festival invites?
I went to the Perth Writers Festival on the weekend the book came out, and then
that would be exciting.
Nearly 2 years later, went to the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Ooh, that would be exciting.
So a long
too.
Time between drinks, but they were both lovely.
But good festivals.
Yeah.
And number of copies sold?
No idea.
Good answer.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe Adie and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.